Welcome everybody to the TechMeme Ride Home Experience. Today is Wednesday, April 5th. We are joined by David Auerbach. David Auerbach is an author. He's a technologist. He's worked at Microsoft back in the day on MSN Messenger. He's worked at Google, back on the web crawler. So we wanted to talk to David because personally, I was in Greece, in Athens recently, and I was giving a talk for The Economist, kind of about how to really think about this current moment that we're in with regards to artificial intelligence and society and social media and all of these things. And I actually listened to an interview with a friend of mine, Daniel Newnham, with David. And a lot of the things that he was talking about related to his new book, Meganets, seemed really pertinent, you know, to our audience, to our interest, to what we've been talking about. And so we invited David on to come give us a talk, or I guess to talk with us about some of these topics. And so with that, I guess, you know, welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me, Chris and Brian.
Yes, welcome, welcome. Chris, since I am not as familiar with David's work as you are, because I didn't listen to that episode.
You did not do your homework.
I know. Tee it off, because I already know what I want to get into with him, but start it in the direction you want to go and I'll follow.
Yeah, you know, I think the thing that's going to be most useful to understand, because I felt a lot of resonance when I was listening to David kind of like Bill tell his story, and then also like thinking about my own journey, you know, with social media and technology. And so I kind of wanted to understand a little bit more just from the earlier days of your experience, one, working on MSN Messenger, which is one of the early chat applications, one of the first maybe examples of a social product or social application. And then going to work, of course, at Google in its hypergrowth era and period. And what that meant to you in terms of, like, one thing that I kind of want to understand, and I think this is true for both of us, is like there wasn't necessarily a master plan to get to where we are now. And as a result, there was a lot of improv. And, you know, now looking back, we can be like, oh man, maybe we should have known differently. But I'm curious about, you know, your experience, especially like starting out with Microsoft. You know, building social products there.
There was no master plan. Well, I mean, or at least any master plan that came up never came to fruition. Microsoft had many master plans back then, and most of them. I worked on a product that was codenamed Hailstorm. Some people might remember it.
Oh, Microsoft Hailstorm. Yeah, wasn't that really bad?
It was actually I think the Microsoft the Developers Conference, they announced it, but I don't think it ever came to fruition.
That's it. You got lucky, Chris, because that's a better answer than him saying, that was my baby. That's the dream I've been trying to return to for 20 years.
I mean, like with a lot of these things, the idea wasn't necessarily terrible, but I don't think Microsoft sort of was in the right mindset to build something like that. They were still effectively client focused. You know, that was what had happened in the 90s, that they decided that they would bring the internet to Windows instead of vice versa. And I was working on the Instant Messenger client, and that was one of the that was one of their successes in the internet realm, but a lot of it was that their user base came from Hotmail, which they purchased, and so like that, it wasn't indicative of, you know, the longer term strategy. So in effect, Microsoft was still operating as like a boxed software company at that point. That there were companies that weren't, but Microsoft still had this idea of that in some ways everything was going to be based around shipping CDs of this or that, even if the internet was an auxiliary.
What about Bill Gates' famous, like, the road ahead, you know, where he was like talking about the future of the internet? I mean, was that just like hyperbole and marketing speak?
I mean, I think that let me see, when did that come out? When did the road ahead come out?
I feel like that was the book was published 98, 99.
No,
because at that time, I think the goal was still that Windows would be the heart of it. That yes,
of course,
everything would be networked, but it would still be Windows connecting you to everything. Ironically, I mean, you can see a little of that happening now with Android. You know, with Android, and the fact that Android and iOS effectively are bases for that we're moving away from a content neutral browser and towards apps and locking down.
Okay, so here I looked up Hailstorm, and Hailstorm was announced in 2001. Okay, 2001.
That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. It was right after September 11th. That's right. Yeah.
Yes. So can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hold on. And so what's interesting about Hailstorm was this is a .NET framework, which is, again, sort of, you know, the Microsoft, you know, way of building applications. And it was described as a new breed of platform consisting of a set of XML-based web services and an underlying services architecture. So, you know, 2001, how we used to talk about things. But then it goes on to talk about, oh, God, what is it? Okay. Hailstorm employs the Passport user authentication system. So identity was even big back then. SAML. Anyways, to secure an individual's identity and information, both Passport and the Hailstorm services require affirmative consent and explicit opt-in by the user for the release of any personal information. And it talks about how this starts with a fundamental assumption that the user owns and controls their personal information, so only the user decides with whom they share their information and under what terms. Now, it's so mind-blowing to me to sort of go back and to think about some of these core concepts that were in play back then. And to think about obviously where we've come and how, you know, Zuckerberg and Bill Gates are kind of, you know, buddies and there's a mentoring relationship, and to see how these core ideas of platforms were established back then.
I mean, that entire idea of identity was there. And it was key is that people are going to have these correlating identities online. And whoever is in charge of adjudicating them and handing them out stands to make a tremendous amount of money. Passport was one of those efforts. And my, you know, Google was up front about trying to do it with Plus, you know,
Google Plus,
identity service. And I write in my book, MegaNets, I talk about how that sort of online identity is happening. It's coalescing. You can see it in India right now with the government Aadhaar program. That, you know, as the amount of information we have online multiplies, the wish to coalesce such things does grow. But is it going to be Microsoft or Google adjudicating it? Who is it going to be adjudicating it? I don't know, but there is going to be that drive towards coalescing it. And that does pose certain risks, I think. When I made the jump from Microsoft to Google, it was like stepping into another world because there was no, you know, nothing was being shipped in a box. This was a truly an internet service, and it was on a scale that Microsoft hadn't come to terms with. I was like, oh, okay, these people really, you know how to run servers and build out server infrastructure in a far more advanced way, you know, well beyond anything. And Microsoft had to play catch up with at this point. They seem to have done so, but it took them quite a while. But making that jump, it was like, oh, okay, we're stepping from this sort of unidirectional world where you give software to people and what they do with it, well, there's bug reports and all, but in effect, they're passive recipients. And that gradually broke down. That Google, you know, at first, it was pretty much web content publishers that had the most influence. Their input is actually feeding into how the creation of whatever it is that Google's doing. But it wasn't until you get to the social media age that you start getting that feedback loop to get tighter and tighter and tighter until, in effect, you get this, you get basically power is devolving onto the users and programmers and corporations and governments don't have the same level of control that they used to because this information is flying around and conditioning and tweaking the parameters of all these algorithms, not just AI. AI, I think, is the most extreme version of this. But, you know, what I saw was the increasing influence that we all collectively had, while none of us individually having a decisive say over it. And that's in the book. That sort of system is what I call a MegaNet, which is one in which, you know, there's a feedback loop between the users and the systems, such that even the such that there's no coordinated human organization that can keep up with what uncoordinated human activity is doing. And you don't need AI for it to get out of control in that way. AI can exacerbate it because now you're putting it through, you know, a machine learning network that is very opaque in its workings. But you have simple recommendation algorithms or you know, much simpler mechanisms of any sort. You're still going to get to this point that you can't exert any fine-grained control over how the recommendation algorithms, feed algorithms, you name it, are being shaped.
Let me, I want to come to the thesis of MegaNets, but I can't resist pulling this anecdote in because we mentioned it and it's my favorite anecdote from, a book that I wrote. But Bill Gates agreed to write The Road Ahead. It came out in November 1995 and the index of the hardcover edition had 68 references to the term information highway and 46 references to the term internet and 4 references to the World Wide Web. About a year later, in the paperback version, the internet suddenly took 169 references and the web suddenly had 59 mentions. So from the paperback to the hardcover, he tried to act like he had the vision all along, which is, you know, if we all had
a good editor.
Yeah, if we all had the chance. That. If we all had the chance to revise ourselves between the hardcover and the paperback, we'd look like geniuses. Okay, so the thesis
that's really funny. I was actually not aware of that.
It is one of my favorite anecdotes. When I was
writing this book, I was very concerned with future proofing it as best as I could. So yeah, we got into the debates of, you need to talk about the metaverse. So every time I mention the metaverse, I put in a little, you know, sort of caveat of, or whatever it is that these things are being called in 10 years.
And this is sort of relevant. Are you familiar with another book called MegaNet?
You know what? Not until it was way too late. I remember by Wilson Dizzard.
Yes.
I literally did not run across this book until.
In some ways, I don't mean to like tease this out like too. To make it too big of a thing. But what I'm finding interesting is sort of like the return of some ideas and some concepts that have been around in the computing world for a while. I was wrong, as you said, Brian, about when Bill Gates published the book. It was 95, not 99. 99 is when I graduated high school. But MegaNet, the first version, well, not the first version, but the Dizzard book was published in 97. And the subtitle of that book was The Global Communications Network That Will Collect Everyone on Earth. And it was about mobile phones and mobile phone penetration. So I find this to be very interesting, right? Because now, you know, 20 some odd years later, you're sort of coming back and in some ways revisiting and like building on the observation of what was happening then with just connecting people through cell phones.
Well, now we're moving to a world. I should have called it GigaNets.
Yeah. Well, perhaps it'll be the sequel. Right. Well, you know, if Bill Gates can rewrite part of his book into the next edition, you know, when you have the paperback version, yours can be the GigaNet. In any case, I think what you're talking about, broadly speaking, with this concept of your MegaNet, is the idea of the feedback loops getting faster and faster. And your transition from Microsoft, from a model of boxed software, where you were literally pressing CDs, shipping them out, and every year you'd have a release cycle. I mean, this is how Adobe built its business. This is why Figma had the advantage. You know, Adobe was still very much predicated on having releases. Whereas when you go to Google, now you're in a world where the code is being updated, you know, hundreds of times a day, where like release management is a whole new discipline. In terms
but
of
I think
cadence.
You can go beyond that, you know, because the algorithm, they're auto-updating. There's new code is being rolled out at discrete but very quick intervals. But moreover, it's not, you know, all the weights of the algorithms are changing in response to user feedback. So you literally are, you know, it's Heraclitus. Mm. You can't walk in the same river twice. You know, and that fundamentally wasn't true 25 years ago, but it's true now that you know, there's no easy guarantee that you're going to get the same output twice in a row. Yeah. And that I think people underestimate what a profound thing that is to say that, because so much of what we think of as how we control and test algorithms starts with the assumption of being able to push a reset button, that we can start with known identical conditions and test in sort of a an isolated, like, white box environment. And you can't do that's becoming more and more impossible. And I from my perspective, that is as big a part of how we've lost control as anything else, that there's no reset button, that you're just dealing with this ongoing evolving systems whose value lies not in their algorithms per se, though they contribute to it, but in their ongoing state. You know, if you were to shut down Facebook and restart it from scratch, you've just thrown away most of the value that Facebook has. I think, you know, the rise of deep learning, machine learning, whatever, is an analogy and an extension of that, because here you have these systems that the algorithms are brilliant, but you have to train them. What are you training them on? You're training them on the massive amount of data that we're now producing that we didn't produce even 20 years ago. But one of my favorite statistics is that we now produce more data every day than was produced in the entire history of humanity before the year 2000.
So
one of the things
that ties exactly into the question, the thesis of the book being in broad terms that people think, these companies have control over their algorithms or even their fundamental businesses, but even in reality, they don't. They're just kind of riding a dragon that maybe they don't have control over. So my fundamental question is, is that the nature of the business that they're in, or is that a business model decision? You know what I mean? Like, is the scale so large that no one would ever reasonably be expected to have their hand on the tiller, or are they deciding for whatever reason, maybe monetarily, whatever, to not have more control?
I mean, primarily the former. Now, it's not to say that you can't do things. I get into this, that you can do things to try to arrest the degree of the loss of control. Like when Facebook banned all political advertising in the run-up to the 2020 election. Well, that's actually, you aren't going to eliminate misinformation on a case-by-case basis, but did that sort of like broad group, fairly content neutral, like coarse grained intervention, that actually can do something. So if you want to look at it from the perspective of, okay, could Facebook mitigate, sheer chaos? Yes, there are options. However, there is nonetheless a degree of fine grained control that you're just never going to get, period, simply because the size, speed, and feedback of these systems is just too fast. If you want to go in and, literally scan every piece of content that's going through Facebook or Twitter and eliminate the bad stuff, for whatever definition of the bad stuff you want, that's not possible. It's not as though, when people are saying, like, stop getting people to be so mean on the internet. No, that's not possible. Now, the companies haven't exactly been upfront in admitting to that, because I think they actually would rather be thought of as greedy than as out of control. But I mean, there's stuff they let through that is, they don't make any appreciable money off of, and that's just vile. And, why? That's a loss of control. That's not great. So, they could be more honest. And I mean, you could also say, okay, well, why don't we just shut everything down? I suppose a company could do that, have that degree of control. That's not going to happen either, I think. But with regard to coarse grain mechanisms, yeah, they have some degree of control. But the myth that, if only they wanted to, things could be nice and the way we used to remember them, no, that's not happening.
In 2023, just 10 vulnerabilities accounted for over half of the incidents responded to by our sponsors today, Arctic Wolf Incident Response. Wouldn't you love to know how to take these vulnerabilities off the table and make life more difficult for cybercriminals? That's just one of the essential insights you'll find inside the Arctic Wolf Labs 2024 Threats Report. authored by their elite team of security researchers, data scientists, and security development engineers, and backed by the data gained from trillions of weekly observations within thousands of unique environments. This report offers expert analysis into attack types, root causes, top vulnerabilities, TTPs, and more. Discover the attack vectors behind nearly half of all successful cybercrimes, why ransom demands climbed 20% from 2023, and find out why 2024 will be an especially volatile year for cybersecurity. Learn more and get your copy now at arcticwolf.com/tech meme. That's arcticwolf.com/tech meme. With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? That's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. With Constant Contact, you'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track growth. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence knowing your emails are actually reaching your customers thanks to Constant Contact's best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. I use this, and you should too. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee. So, get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
One of the things that I thought was pretty interesting was you wrote in 2015 when you were describing machine learning, which, you know, given the timing, I thought was pretty early. And you wrote this for Slate. You wrote, and this sort of was describing the shift from, you know, somewhat like declarative deterministic programming, where you sort of build an app, you press some buttons, you know, like you press the copy button and it copies, and then you press paste and then it pastes.
So beautiful.
Right? Yes. To a world which is somewhat more probabilistic. So you wrote, the question then is, why would one want to generate opaque and unpredictable networks rather than writing strict, effective programs oneself? And the answer, as Pedro Domingos told you, was that complete control over the details of the algorithm doesn't scale, and that there are three related aspects to machine learning that mitigate this problem. One, it uses probabilities rather than the true false binary. Now, of course, this sort of goes back to your book, Bitwise. Two, humans accept a loss of control and precision over the details of the algorithm. And three, the algorithm is refined and modified through a feedback process. So why I think this is so relevant, you know, to revisit 7 years later is because we are now in the enthralling kind of era of scaled machine learning and artificial intelligence, where everyone slowly but surely is going to realize that they are part of this feedback mechanism, that, as you say, like this process of moving to a world of sort of probabilistic software is more like living in weather patterns. And, you know, what do we have? We have weather people that attempt to predict the weather, and they could be right 50% of the time and keep their jobs. In a similar way, we have these large scale AI systems that are, we attempt to predict their outputs. We attempt to improve them through modeling predictions that get better over time. But we also have to improve their performance through reinforcement mechanisms, whether human or virtual.
Right. And yeah, I mean, at some point, you're going to need AIs to assess the performance of AIs. And well, you can see where the circular dependency originates, that at some point it's like you're measuring yardsticks with yardsticks. And how are you going to find what the right yardstick is? And no, it's a real issue. This is why I think all those debates about machine bias and things miss the point a bit, because we're going to have trouble just determining whether something is biased. You can say, how are you going to audit, even at a black box level, how do you audit the performance? There are definitely ways to do it if in controlled scenarios, but if everything's changing so fast, it's going to be a real problem.
I think, to your commentary about like never stepping into the same river twice, like, isn't the nature of reality, and, you know, this is going to get metaphysical very quickly, so, you know, warning to the listeners, but if reality is constantly and always changing, one of the challenges with durable memory systems is that they attempt to record like a steady state of reality in a certain moment of time and persist it eternally. But everything is changing constantly. And so you need to have a system that in and of itself has the ability to constantly be kind of updating its model, adjusting its model. I mean, even the use of the word bias, like an entire neural network is based on a set of biases in the system.
Exactly.
Towards an interpretation of reality.
Exactly.
So I guess like where this leads me to is the change that is about to become like common in society and the world is one in which we have this new type of relationship, this emergent relationship that is a co-modification between our sense of self and our sense of the machine that we're working with. And that from one moment to the next, you know, I may be using my chat, you know, software or something, and then it may have updated. And we, you know, we see this with auto updating software now. You know,
yeah.
I am one of those strange holdouts that still wants to update all my apps on my phone. But for most people, their apps and their app experience is very much like the web. You know, they go there one day and someday, you know, the feature has changed or the search index is updated.
Right.
Something is different. Things have moved. Instagram is constantly moving things around, taking things, you know, A/B testing, whatever. So even the fact of software is becoming one that is a lot more fungible and a lot more changeable. Yeah. And so and that creates a little bit of incoherence.
Well, that, you know, it's funny you bring this up and that, yeah, this was true at Google back 20 yeah. years ago with search, with ranking. I didn't work on ranking. Why? Because it was subject to exactly these sorts of feedback probabilistic mm-hmm. mechanisms that made it very difficult. I wanted to build something that went from 0 to 100% accuracy. And the ranking people are miserable trying to get from 70% to 71%.
Exactly.
And they're having trouble just figuring out whether something's an improvement or not. Just so, I mean, those issues were seen in miniature then. The Google, I think, was very fortunate in that they hit a gold mine. They hit the gold mine where they had this mechanism, this context in which people would tell them exactly what they were looking for so they could sell ads on exactly what they were looking for. I don't think there's been anything like that since then. I don't think Facebook found it. No one else has found a gold mine as Google did on the internet. They found it at the right time and they grabbed it. But even then, you know, how the relevancy of search results, I think, you know, it was about like 70%, but that's okay. You don't need search results to be 70%. So the issue, and they were, you know, they were using machine learning like mechanisms. They were using Bayes nets and things like that. You know, those AI things were in play, just not at the level that you see them now. And they weren't being used on analog data as you see them now. But those things were in play and you were seeing this that loss of control. Also because the webmasters would then change around all of their stuff to try to gain the engine,
right.
And Google would have to go back and change it again. So there was also the users in terms of the webmasters shaping how the ranking algorithms worked. It worked very well for a while, you know.
I think what's, one thing that's important about this observation and this point about the dynamic between search and then webmasters and what became the industry of search engine optimization is the same thing. If you imagine, like, you know, the bazaar, you know, thousands of years ago, where, you know, being closest to like the entryway is going to help you have a better business. So in a similar way, someone comes to the market, they're looking for, I don't know, grapes or wine, perhaps. And, you know, if you're closer to the entryway, then of course you'll do more business. So what I'm teasing out though, is that there is this dynamic in the feedback loops that were starting with Google. Essentially, there was this back and forth that seemed to be happening where Google would do one thing, and it would, you know, like there was a whole Panda kind of search algorithm change that affected a bunch of people, et cetera. Webmasters learned how to design their pages to do keyword stuffing
again,
and all these things.
Remember, Chris, I'm an entrepreneur who has scars from these words.
That's true.
So,
yes. You were on the battlefield of that era. But my point is though, is that this is kind of evidence of those early meganets like forming, where there was kind of a command and response or a market opportunity, you know, where there were incentives And then and those that's, incentives.
I cover that, and I cover that in the book exactly, because that was when we see it firing. And that was when I observed what I thought was, if there was a single assumption, shared false assumption, I think tech companies, programmers, product managers, all of us, we all underestimated the degree of influence that users collectively would have on the system. We didn't think of it in those terms. Why would we? You know, it didn't make sense historically. The idea of making something and the users being passive recipients was still there, even though, you know, we were now surviving on these industries were based on content provided by the users. And so I think, and I don't think that people even began to have an inkling until the era of social media, because at that point it really starts to get out of control and you start to see actual, you know, side effects. I mean, we had SEOs can be so annoying or whatever, but I think there was always this sense of like, whatever, we'll just, you know, there was no doubt about who was going to win. You know, the SEOs are annoying, but we're in charge. Well, as it turns out, the more of a voice people have and the faster these systems are working, the more you're giving up control. And I think that is the main fallacy that we all had, because I can't think of anyone that I knew who was talking about user influence, collective user influence in that way. As I said, I mean, I was wary of it. I didn't like just the unpredictability of it. But at that time, I didn't see it as going so far in this direction.
It occurs to me that, again, like, this is, to put it in like historical context, we've been talking about putting software in a shrink wrap box and selling it on a shelf or whatever. But if you think of the 20th century and you create a product like a car, you sell that car to the end user, to borrow that term. And that's kind of it with your relationship with them. I mean, you get feedback in terms of this model year sold better than that model year or whatever. Like, the fact that in a digital economy, there is no sell it and it's done. And we were talking about like iterating different versions and such like that. But also, like, that's part of the nature of selling a digital product, is that you have all of this feedback, so that it's almost like, as the producer of the product, you're overwhelmed by what you're learning about how it's used as well. Like,
yeah, I mean, you become followers as much as leaders. And I think this is true across the board. I think that, you know, if you look at, I think Elon Musk has maintained influence in part because he actually jumps on currents that are already in play, and that we see that, you know, names become figureheads. I mean, albeit, you know, very rich and powerful figureheads, but that, you know, someone can just become the voice and figurehead of what is actually a more decentralized or at least leaderless movement, because you've got systems that are grouping similar people together who share similar interests, who can then exert themselves in a coordinated way that wasn't possible before. And this can happen organically without anyone like driving it, because all you need to do is to say, okay, look, give people more of what they want and introduce them to other people who want the same things. And that by itself is enough to sort of start the ball rolling.
You want another fun anecdote, which you may or may not be aware of, but when I had Matt Cutts on the Internet History Podcast, he said that one of the ways that they intelligence from the SEOs is they would go to the SEO conferences and be very friendly and take them out for drinks or whatever. And he was like, after a few drinks, they would just tell you. They would just tell you what they're doing. Like,
Matt's a great guy. I didn't know him well, but he had a fairly thankless job and did it really, really well. Yeah. I don't know where he is now, actually.
At least 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah,
sorry.
I think that's right.
Matt works for
the White House.
Really?
Yeah, he is. He was the current head of the USDS, and that was as of 2018.
Yeah,
US Digital Service. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Yes. I had no idea. Well, he was. I mean, he was really the point person on that thing, and he did an amazing job. He was really the crux of it. He handled a lot of people getting very upset with him on a regular basis.
I mean, it does, to your point about Elon Musk, it is sort of like the kind of thing where now it's not just like, again, walking in and out of the river and it's a different river. It's now actually finding kind of like the currents and riding those currents, and in such a way where you're kind of like a multipolar identity or personality, such that there are many people, many actors in the system that are all kind of convening on you, as you said, like the figurehead that is drawing the ire of many different groups, both, you know, positive, negative, and whatever. And that balance seems to be the thing that kind of keeps people, I don't know, in the public eye or something.
Or another example was, you know, the GameStop stonk guy.
Exactly.
His name. Do you remember his name? He testified in front of Congress.
His name.
But yeah, it seemed very clear he wasn't some mastermind. He happened to basically be in this right place at the right time and was a visible person talking about GameStop. But he, in effect, was representing a disparate group of people. He wasn't some, you know, demagogue who was hyping people up. He was one more YouTube celeb. And where has he gone? I don't know. You know, these people they rise and they.
I could be wrong, but I believe he's suing Reddit because they.
Yes, they shut it down, right? Yeah, or something.
Like that. But anyway, really? That could be wrong. Yeah. Listen, I do a daily news show, so I can't remember.
Yeah, a lot of talk comes about, across your turn from
3 hours ago. But can I jump in real quick and then Chris, back to you. One of the other things that I think you get into is this idea that you know, what Facebook and Google need to do is just take all the misinformation and the bad stuff out, and then that'll fix everything. And especially as AI is coming, I'm curious your thoughts on that. To me, sounds like absolutely the horses are out of the barn. Should we be thinking about not finding ways for average users or most users to not never see anything false or bad or whatever, but find a way to identify what they're seeing for what it is, XYZ. I'm sorry, I'm rambling. So go ahead and let me know your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is that even identifying it is tricky enough, and that because unless there's something that you can get, you know, 95% agreement on, and there's not a lot of that these days, then you're always going to have, it's very difficult to locate where that authority should lie. If it's in private companies, I don't think private companies even want that. It's nothing but a headache for them. If it's the government, well, they have tons of restrictions on exactly how they can adjudicate this themselves. You know, the idea, the problem is that the myth of, you know, the Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act is that there aren't any of these networks that are truly unfiltered anymore. Everybody's exerting some control. And you saw the Supreme Court hearings earlier this year, where it seemed like the justices were genuinely torn because they recognized that these weren't sort of just neutral carriers in the way that, say, a phone network was. But at the same time, they did seem to recognize, wait, how on earth are you going to make Google responsible for everything that's on their network? What the heck? They literally can't do it. So they're confronting, I think you're going to be confronting a lot of these problems legally, because there's going to be basically total pressure not to accrue any liability to any company of a big size. They want to devolve responsibility onto individual users. But unfortunately, since individual users don't control the distribution of what they say, it becomes a paradox. So that's why my suggestion is to say, look, you know, you're not going to, it's just going to be whack-a-mole no matter what. If you want to address it, you're going to have to look at just things like basically slowing down viral spread of everything, not of specific types of content, because identifying specific types of content in ways that a supermajority of the population won't find objectionable or wrongheaded is not feasible. Now there are exceptions. If there's some huge earthquake, no one's going to hopefully not too many people are going to dispute that. So, the rawest of urgent news, you can still sort of prioritize in that way.
So what you're describing is people have pejoratively called shadow banning, but you're not saying shadow banning for specific things. You're almost saying turning the temperature down on the virality of everything.
Yeah. Well, I would say don't shadow, because, if you shadow ban everyone, then nobody's shadow banned. Right.
Right.
So what I would say is effectively the louder something gets, make it quieter, introduce some negative feedback. And break up homogeneous groupings. In other words, there's this assumption that you should give people what they want. And so all these algorithms are designed to give people things that stoke engagements, things that get what they want. That in itself is a lot more problematic than people seem to think, because giving people what they want is not always the greatest idea. And it's just that was a way to sort of kick the can down the road. Well, we're not going to decide what you want. We're just going to give what you want. Unfortunately, I think we're seeing that that there's some emergent properties when you do that that lead to nastiness. Like if you give people what they want, and what they want is some really is stuff that a lot of other people think is bad or whatever, you've just exacerbated it. So
I think this raises a very interesting generational X societal or cultural question, which is to the degree to which these things are kind of, bad for us, both individually and collectively. It's almost like an information nutrition problem. And, we've had to learn and teach ourselves over time what is sort of a balanced and healthy approach to consuming calories and a distribution of calories and proteins and vitamins and all the rest in order to maintain something of a healthy existence. In a similar way, I think the question of digital health, or God, what was the word I used? Anyways, going along those lines, hygiene. Thank you. Yes, I call it data hygiene. There is a question as to the degree to which we need to teach people about these systems, about how they are affected by these systems, and also how they affect the systems themselves. And yet, I guess I'm curious if you touched on this in the book, what are interventions that could actually happen at scale where you change the fitness function of humanity to be or to be living within the meganet?
That's the last chapter of the book, which is what you can do.
Okay, great.
That is because I think that these meganets are, you can't educate people enough, because it's like educating people to recycle and use less fuel. It's not and doesn't make enough of an impact. You need some sort of.
But it's going to be a both ands. I mean, because we now, this is the first, 2023 will be the first year that people are able to use something like ChatGPT in all aspects of their educational experience. However, education now is changing in terms of its function in society and culture, because you can just ask ChatGPT to do 90% of the work or more for you.
Right.
And as you know, and as I know, the cleverness of people is such that they will find ways to use and incorporate these tools in very subtle ways. I remember you told a story about MSN Messenger and AOL Instant Messenger and how you sort of had forced or adversarial interoperability. Yeah. That is an example of the type of cleverness that humans will invent to get around what other types of censorship or kind of prohibitions that may be invented. I mean, prohibition itself was something that people found their way around. So in your view, how do we prepare people to be able to take advantage of these tools while not also usurping, to use your word, their own sense of self-sovereignty?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're doomed on that one. But the thing is,
thank you for coming.
Gradually outsourcing more and more of our thought, labor, whatever, to computers, and that's just the way that things are going. You aren't going to, you aren't going, so the self has already, I think, changed inalterably. I think that, you know, this idea, you know, the existentialist idea of, oh, you're a blank slate, you can reinvent yourself at any time. Well, no, you now got a huge digital paper trail a mile long. Everybody knows what you've been. So in other words, your identity has already been getting locked down in ways that it never was locked down before. So I think we are looking at a fundamental change of identity. I think we're looking at an identity that's much more quantified. People are defining themselves much more with labels, labels upon labels upon labels. So, you know, and you can argue whether that's good or bad. I'm not a fan of it, but whatever, it's here. My concern is more in terms of, I think, preventing sort of those viral, harmful viral explosions in which there is a sudden shock or destabilization of the system that causes massive damage, you know, akin to that of like the 2008 financial crisis and high frequency.
I was going to say SVB.
Yeah.
Right? Like, is there an equivalent in the information system such that an SVB style information trauma would not have cascading effects?
Right. And I mean, you're seeing that happen with cryptocurrency, because, you know, whatever we've seen in cryptocurrency is nothing compared to what we're going to see, because it's getting more and more integrated into the global financial system. And if you look at, you know, at FTX, you look at it's like, how did these people convince anyone that they were serious in retrospect? And part of that is because there's so much information that validating information, you know, and making sober assessments of, oh, is this sane or not? Is this offshore crypto company sane or not? I suspect it was done because they had the right pedigree. And that was basically the shorthand.
Yeah. Well, they had all the labels that would identify them as being credible or worthy of being believed or believable in the network archaeology or topology.
Yeah.
And as a result, they.
Whereas, you know, a few decades ago, you wouldn't have just needed that. You would have also had to come into a room and schmooze with people.
Right.
It wasn't necessary. And I mean, I'm not saying that that was perfect at all. It led to nepotism of a different sort. But what we're seeing now is that you can actually do this remotely, and it opens the door to people's BS detectors not firing because everything.
They have been trained on these types of bacteria. Totally. Brian?
Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you ka-ching. As you know, I still run the first company I ever founded 25 years ago entirely on Shopify these days. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow the whole way. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is that you can take any business to the next level, even 25-year-old ones, but especially 25-day-old ones. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ride, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ride now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/ride. Love, love, love Yahoo Finance. Use it every day to research companies we talk about on the show. Heck, I used it constantly when I was writing the book to look at the historical performance of .com companies. But when I'm working on my own portfolio, it's also the autocomplete in my browser, yahoofinance.com. They are the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. And when you use it for your personal investing tool like I do, you can securely link your brokerage accounts to it for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. When it comes to your financial future, you think you've done it all, you've saved, you've researched, you've invested all that you can. Now, you need to take those investments to the next level by using what every financial great uses, Yahoo Finance. Think of it as an observability dashboard, but for your finances. With a community of over 90 million users each month, their real strength is helping you on your way to financial success. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com. Yeah, taking it 15 degrees to the right or left a little bit. We have thousands of listeners that work at big tech companies, tech platforms, that I don't think any of them will be surprised at your assertion that no one's really in control, you know?
I know. That's why I start off the book. I say, you know, there's this conversation I have where every people is like, well, why don't you just fix that? And all the engineers I know are like, this is
okay. Hilarious. Well, so I guess maybe this is unfair, but my question was going to be, a listener like that believes either in their company or in their original, why did I get into tech? I want to, you know, make a dent in the universe. If you're working at these platforms, do you have any advice for those folks who want to make them better?
I mean, yeah, I think that what you want to look at is what interventions actually have been effective. And I mean, to some extent, you know, even the people on the ground, I'd say this from experience, you know, often engineers are being told to do impossible things by executives. So they may also don't have advice on how to change that, I'm afraid. The advice I give at the end of the book, or some suggestions, is to look at these not as non-targeted mechanisms of making recommendation algorithms, messing with them and breaking up homogeneous coagulations of social groupings and content groupings, and in effect, you know, not requiring a greater degree of data validation. You know, there's so much data that goes through that often is not accurate. You know, Facebook thought I was black for a number of years. They may still. I didn't tell them that. I don't know where they got that from. If there was more of an emphasis on even validating, elective third-party data, that would do something for it, but you wouldn't even have to validate it. You could just poison it and say, okay, look, we're not going to go on the assumption that this data is correct, or we're just going to intentionally corrupt it because we can't validate it anyway. So mix things up. I know TikTok was actually trying to show more heterogeneous content to people after, a lot of like pro anorexia videos were getting shown and recommended. That's the sort of thing that I think can work, is that you're not looking at stamping that stuff out. You just don't want you just want people to be taken out of a narrative bunker in which everything they see has the same set of shared assumptions.
So you're kind of talking about sort of introducing some decay perhaps into the system, some way to get people out of their kind of information cul-de-sac.
I think that will help a lot. Yeah, along with the sort of the negative feedback mechanisms to decrease viral spread and prevent anything from blowing up too big, too quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that's
experimenting with those sorts of what I would suggest to people who are who work at these companies. I mean, the thing is, these companies themselves are frequently huge entities. So the will to do so, it often has to come from even one company isn't enough. You need to you need to get coordination between multiple companies to agree to do things. That could happen. In effect, I guess even simpler than that, I would say start thinking about things from a more systematic perspective rather than looking at individual actors, because the individual actors, you can't shape them that much. I remember God, I remember someone suggesting many years ago, oh, shaming people on Twitter with pop-ups to like prevent them from acting too negative. And I was like, yeah, that, sure, that'll work.
They have that. It did show that there was some, it's one of those sort of like, I don't, it's not attunement, but it's like, eventually you become sort of inured to them. And like, if you want to you know, call someone a fuckwit, like you will. And it's just like, too bad.
Yeah.
Like I get them sometimes and I'm like, no, actually that's what I really want to say, you know?
Yeah, or you express yourself in ways that don't trigger. I mean, it's like, you know, China's exactly, been trying to do this for a long time and with varying success. So
one thing is that
it's like, I think I quote this in the book. My favorite headline, this was from 2016, was "It's time for the elites to rise up against the ignorant masses." Like the mere fact that you have to write an article and publish it with that title shows that it's not going to happen. You know?
One thing that I want to bring up as we wrap here is, you know, you wrote about Wittgenstein, and I don't think we've ever brought up Wittgenstein on this podcast before. And I will admit
that's
that
where
I
the yardstick heard. Analogy is from, actually. I actually already brought him up. Yeah.
I feel like I'm over the next period of time, I'm going to need to actually do a little bit more digging, because a lot of his philosophy around language and words and the experience of words is so pertinent to this moment that we're in, right? This large language model kind of epoch that is upon us is exactly one in which, as you were talking about, like labels and labels being either self-asserted or applied to other people, determines in some ways like who you are to the system and what recommendations you receive. And so the degree to which there is not a label that is sufficient to describe you or your interests or perhaps the negative space, which are negative labels, which are things that you haven't experienced yet, could be an opportunity to essentially create, you know, sort of a backlog of like, here are all the ideas that are still out there that you haven't yet discovered yet. And, you know, like it's sort of like negative space recommendation system.
Well, I think we all go around assuming, you know, with this idea that things are more that our language, linguistic expression, even our concepts are more grounded than they actually are. And if you look back at the history, it's concepts evolve at an incredible
rate. I mean, as we started, Bill Gates was like, oh, that's not the words I really mean. I mean these words over here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was walking by a house, an apartment complex yesterday, and I was like, oh, well, it was weird. And turns out that it used to be a hospital, but it looked like a little like fortress with circular, like a bunch of circular cylinders connected together. And I looked it up and it's like, oh, it was created because at the time the thinking was that corners spread disease. That's why they had these round. No, this is really the reason. I was like, that's why they've got these round cylindrical things. I was like, there's so much that will get revised going forward, and we're expecting machines to grasp and track that evolution. It's going to be inexact. And that's Wittgenstein's, you know, contribution, is to say that language is the yardstick that you're measuring with another yardstick, that you don't have something to appeal to and say, okay, did I say that right or not? And in effect, we're all doing a bit of legislation and saying, okay, this is how I think language should be used every time we speak. And I think we're telling that to ChatGPT.
Right.
And by speaking, ChatGPT is legislating to us as well. And that's the new.
I think the thing, you know, just again, to like close this out, one of the things that was really, that really stood out to me, and why I think the concept of MegaNets appealed to me, was, of course, with my relationship to the hashtag, it has created kind of flocking behavior within people, where previously, like, there weren't, you know, words that existed that captured a certain, you know, idea or experience, and that upon sort of like the invention in the flow of language, you know, whether it's like hashtag Me Too or hashtag Black Lives Matter, these were words that didn't have purchase previously. And then through these feedback mechanisms and the speed of those feedback mechanisms, now you can have broad participation by a set of people that previously perhaps were not franchised. And
They act as attractors. Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly.
And I mean, I think I mean, so this is my own philosophical bias, which is that I don't think language works the same online as it does in person. That I think there's something fundamentally different about talking to people in that sort of disconnected way, as opposed to speaking to them in an embodied world, because basically you're taking away that much more grounding of, okay, like, oh, I'm pointing to this and we're speaking the same language. And I think the way that gets compensated for is that you fold yourself into a micro community that speaks the same language, and these terms become identified. It's not just the terms with which you identify yourself. It's also a whole vocabulary. You know, if you're talking about wokeness, that's very different than if you're talking about intersectionality. The mere use of those terms is enough to
It's inclusive or exclusive.
Well, it's also it's interesting because everyone's like, well, you would never say that to me if I was in front of you, but you'll comment and say terrible things to me on my YouTube post or whatever. But what you're saying is like the actual functionality of the language is different.
I think so. Yeah. I think that if you look at it, like it can't make meaning in the way that it does in real life, or at least it does so. It's much more
like with memification and like the shorthand that is how the, not to use memes, but like that's almost a grammar that is not used. It's used, like we quote from movie lines and stuff to each other in person at a bar watching the football game or whatever, but it's not used as much as it is online for that.
Yeah. So a way to think about like language as an operating system is like there's a bootstrapping method by which you kind of arrive at saying, what is the sort of assumptions or primitives or, I guess language modules that we can take for granted. And memes from movies only work if you are in the same operating system culture, because you've seen the same movies, right? When there are memes that are from Indian culture, Japanese culture, they don't make any sense to me because I haven't seen the movies and I have no idea what they're talking about. So that vernacular is lost on me because I'm in the wrong operating system.
Yeah, and now you're getting, and I think the thing is that, you know, there's no overriding mass culture to the extent that there was 40 years ago, even when I was growing up. No one watches I don't think you could even get something like the end of The Sopranos anymore, where everybody was complaining about it. Like you have
even Succession, right? Like it's still like there's so much content.
I love Succession, but it's a particular demographic. It's still niche.
And I was like momentarily in like the Last of Us niche, and we were all sharing. Yeah.
Well, but also think about there's another thing. Think about the time shifting of it, where everybody watched MASH at the same time. Everyone now knows The Wire or Breaking Bad. Sure. Not everyone, but not everyone did in the same time scale as well. So like there was a language for people that were on The Wire or Breaking Bad from day one that for years people that was a language that they didn't understand.
Yeah. And now I think it's fracturing even more. That I mean I The Wire, I think that's still gonna has a much bigger resonance than Succession will. And I love Succession, so I'm not going to complain about it, but one of the nice things about sort of like dropping into different subcultures is, you'll stumble on stuff that seems to be, that no one in your, peer group has ever heard of. Someone brought up the Russian video game Pathologic last night, and I was like, holy crap, I happen to have played that, but I can't say that I've talked to anyone else who has. It was really, it was just like, what are the chances? And that's the thing, is that there's the sheer volume of it is such that it's hard to make something for a mass audience, that because there's that much less of a shared collective knowledge.
Well, okay. Last thought though, like when you say mass audience, I mean, if there was, I don't know if it was 2 million or 70 million people that watched the last episode of MASH, but these days,
it was like 80
relatively
million,
speaking, 80 million. Like, what is a mass audience? If you can get out there to 80 million today, and that's a relatively modest audience, it's still as big as the greatest mass audience of the previous epoch. So is it just a matter that we are living with just a different scale of access and communication?
I think
so. And that is, it's like counting weather.
The bar of content creation has dropped more too. I mean, soon enough, people will literally be, you know, I could, you know, I'll be able to make a new Humphrey Bogart movie in 20 years,
right,
with whatever machine learning
tools are out there.
I was going to say like 20 days.
Yeah.
With Runway ML or...
So I mean, maybe sooner, but that's the thing, is that the bar of content creation and content distribution. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously there are people who are trying to, you know, keep control of that, but it is slipping gradually. I think everyone will agree with that. And I think that it's accelerating since interest rates went up. There's less money being fed into, you know, VC-backed firms. And so there's that much less attempts to control sort of, you know, what's popular and what's big. So succession, you know, however much you like it, is that idea of a prestige show, I think, is somewhat dying out as well. Simply because, you know, I might be able to find something that I like more. And so not enough
cost less to produce.
Not, there's never a critical mass for anything.
Well, let's let's not even get started about, there was a time when everyone saw the same movie that wasn't a superhero movie. Like, okay. We should wrap. I'm going to do the plugs and then Chris will, right, close us out. David Auerbach, the book that we've been talking about mostly is Meganets, How Digital Forces Beyond Our Control Commandeer Our Daily Lives and Inner Realities. He has a previous book called Bitwise, A Life in Code. Check those both out. I'm going to thank you personally, and now Chris is going to thank you.
Yeah, well, again, David, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. This is great.
I really appreciate it. Where shall people go to find more about you? Either follow you on some social media platform, or
let's see. Well, if you search on Meganets, you'll turn up.
Oh, this is the best thing. I searched for Meganets.
That's probably the best thing.
You will find no. If you search for Meganets,
I have a Substack.
You'll get
our stack. AUER and then stack. I have our stack. I'm on Twitter as Auerbach Keller, which is a Goethe reference, which no one ever gets, but it's a reference to Faust. So I should probably change that, but whatever. I'm in the other usual spots too, but reading the book, hey, that's probably the best thing to do. And for the coders out there, yes, I made it Bitwise so that people would know that I had some idea what I was talking about.
Your own little self-label there. All right. Well, David, thank you very much for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.